Welcome to the Creation Theatre Podcast. This week we have been on our travels. As we're performing in Blackwell's Bookshop at the moment, we were invited to the Litfest Marquee, which is a beautiful construction full of books and coffee and all the other things you would want in life, just by the Bodleian. It's kind of the hub for the Litfest. And we were invited to do a panel on, we called it Freud, Feminism and Fangs. So the kind of background, a bit of the kind of psychology and the thinking behind our currently running version of Dracula. So you'll hear from me and Ginny from Creation and Helenin and Kate, the writer and director of the show, and we'll get cracking with that.
We had previously called this talk Freud, Feminism and Fangs, so generally around those three F's. And then if any of you guys have got any questions, we'd love to take some questions from the floor. Just pop your hand up at any point. So a good question to get started on is, why do you think vampire fiction endures? Why are we still scared of vampires, and why are we still scared of vampires?
Yeah, you go.
You go first.
I am still scared of vampires. But I'm also a bit scared of the dark, so I think I might just be a bit of a wimp. But I think that we are always a bit fascinated by the bad in us and the bad self, and I think that's what we're really drawn to, the things that we can't necessarily express and be socially acceptable, and what underlines us and what our true identity is. I think that's what we're really drawn to them, and that's what we're experimenting with in the show, really.
Yeah, I second that. I think it's all about the kind of the sexuality and the allure of the vampires. And I think, and the mix of sex and death. They're all about sex and death, and those are two things that we're all absolutely fascinated by, and they're kind of at the core of what it means to be human, but we repress a lot of that. I'm not scared by vampires, but my dad came to see the show and was absolutely terrified.
The show's quite scary.
So, is it a fear of ourselves then, rather than a fear of an external thing? It's not the vampire with the teeth at the window. It's the fear of what it's bringing out inside ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, because there's a degree to which that is quite farcical, isn't it, as an idea, but it is what it's symbolic of. I think that's why it's enduring, really.
And that's certainly what we looked at within the adaptation and within this production. We ran with the idea that Jonathan and Mina, as our central couple, are repressing their sexuality, so they're in this new marriage and they can't really express their sexual desire for each other. The vampirism Dracula represents that kind of unfiltered lust.
Yeah, and I think it's also, particularly in Dracula, I don't know if it's true for all vampires, but in Dracula you have to invite the vampire in. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the ways in which we might choose our own self-destruction is quite interesting as well.
Do you think, I sort of have the feeling that we've maybe civilised the vampire. So if you think about the kind of early sort of black and white films of vampires, and it's horror, basically, it's kind of rapping at the window. But then you get all the way up to kind of Twilight and sparkly vampires, who the main thing about them is they've just been around for ages, so they know loads, and they're really civilised. Everyone in Blackwell's will know there's a TV adaptation being made at the moment of a story which is set in Oxford, and it's a witch and a vampire falling in love, and the vampires are sort of dangerous, but they're also kind of civilised. They sort of become like professorial a bit, like, just because I feel like we've kind of blunted the teeth.
Well,
Dracula
is a bit like that, isn't he? He knows everything, and he's, you know, wants to speak and adopt different civilizations and things like that.
I suppose there is a knowledge in that kind of amorality that the Dracula represents, or that vampires represent, and that's a knowledge, and they kind of represent a shadow self, and there's a knowledge in that shadow self, and there's something about owning all, and I suppose the making vampires more acceptable is about that route to assimilating the vampire within us, assimilating the shadow self within us, and therefore being a more complete person, and that is knowledge.
Yeah, and that you kind of lose the sort of the freak show horror part, because that's actually the bit that's not particularly convincing or kind of compelling, because it's sort of other, whereas if you can civilise the vampire a bit, then it's basically us.
Does a vampire have to be very handsome, generally speaking? There is a version of Sleeping Beauty, and if so, why is this shadow self?
I don't think the vampire, I mean, I think the modern vampires that you're talking about, they are very handsome, it's true. But I don't think they have to be. If you think about Nosferatu, for instance, they don't have to be very handsome. And I think the allure is in the kind of the predatory power, the sexual power, the mortality, immortality. That's where the power lies, rather than in a kind of whatever the contemporary aesthetic of handsome or attractive for a female vampire as well.
And I think they're attractive as well, in a sense, because they prey on people who want what they have, don't they? You always want what you haven't got. So there is kind of the Hollywood thing has run with that, hasn't it? But actually, they are attractive in another sense, I think, but not necessarily aesthetically.
I don't profess to understand it fully. I mean, I was terrified when I first read Dracula.
You probably wouldn't be so scared now.
No.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we've done in this production, which was actually the idea of Lucy Askew, who's the chief exec of Creation Theatre, was that you never see Dracula, which I think is quite exciting, and it was certainly really fun to work with directorially. And there is something about if you never see the vampire, then you can project all your fears and desires onto that idea of the vampire. And it's kind of easier to do if you don't see a person representing Dracula, because that person may not live up to your imagination. And of course, the joy of theatre, and as in the joy of good literature, is that you engage your imagination. It's not just all handed to you.
There's a lot in Dracula about repression of desire and about miscommunication, and with the adaptation that we've put on in Black Closet at the moment, we focus a lot on the relationship between Jonathan and Mina and how they're struggling to communicate with each other since he came back from Transylvania, and how that changes as they start to let kind of Dracula have more control over their lives and how he comes in. What do you think Freud would say about all of that?
What he'd say about their relationship.
Yeah, about their relationship and about how their relationship is really struggling when they're trying to repress their desires. Yeah. But then as soon as they let themselves be taken over by it, that's when, although there's a sort of negative impact of that, of vampirism infecting them and then will go on to affect everyone around them, it actually gives them a lot of freedom.
Oh yeah, I think it's wholly positive when they when they embrace their inner vampire. I think it's a marvellous thing.
Well, Freud was actually quite negative about that, though, in a sense, wasn't he, about the pleasure principle and how if we run with it, we're going to completely self-destruct. And I suppose what we were playing with is the idea that Mina holds on to her reality in a really practical way, with real intensity, actually, so she can never really access this idea of pleasure and living for, you know, physical and psychological stimulation. So it's how you cope with not having a drive for pleasure, I think. But if you let it run free, you're stuffed, aren't you?
But that's interesting, because then in contrast to Lucy, who is who's dead by the time we're telling this story, who has gone with it, you know, she's enjoyed her life, she's had a lot of sex, she's had a really good time, and she's now dead and she's been caught by the vampire first of all.
Yeah, so she gets punished. I think it's kind of, I mean, that kind of, I suppose, brings us to gender stuff, in that she's she is more sexually confident, is more flirtatious, and of course she's the one that becomes the vampire and is intimidating it as the vampire and becomes an it rather than a woman. She starts to be referred to as an it. She's ungendered when she becomes sexually confident. And then the method of killing the vampire is, you know, this stabbing with the stake, which obviously is very phallic. So she's punished, you know, she's punished for being a sexually confident woman. So within the book, there is this kind of your usual virgin whore kind of stuff, because Mina is seen as the more virginal one, and she's, you know, represses those kind of sexuality.
Yeah, she's repeatedly told that she's pure by all the different men in the book, and pure and perfect and passive, isn't she?
Yes. And we wanted to unpick some of that a little bit by creating a character that did have sexual desires. And we looked also at the kind of the gender between those two characters, because, I mean, a lot of, going back to Freud, a lot of the Freudian analysis of Dracula has focused on the kind of wanting to kill Dracula as the bad father figure and all that kind of stuff, and has focused on the male characters. But one of the things about Jonathan is that he actually becomes quite passive in a lot of ways. So he kind of goes against some of those Freudian interpretations. And in that passivity and in that being ill, he is no longer kind of able to fulfill the traditional masculine protector role, and that's so that's a kind of gender challenge within their relationship. So we were quite interested in exploring that, what they both as characters have expectations of very traditional gender roles, and what happens then when the circumstances don't allow the characters to fulfill those roles. How do they manage that, and how do they move beyond that?
And you guys are going to lean in. You've gone for 1950s, like if anybody hasn't seen the show or the material, so kind of pulled it out of the kind of Victorian, but not all the way up to modern day, because it's easier to, or it's sort of easier to make the sort of cognitive leap to, well, this is plausible if it's 1950 something, if it's kind of mid-century, then they are trying to live in these roles, which now we might have more kind of trouble sort of the audience fighting against that, but you just go, oh, I see, they're kind of... that's what's expected of them.
Yeah. And the 50s was really interesting. It was your choice, wasn't it? And it came partly from the space that we were in and not wanting to work against the sort of aesthetics of the space. But it was also really interesting from a gender perspective, because post-war, obviously, women had been out in the workplace during the war and then found themselves being pulled back into the home, and sort of those gender roles became more rigid again. And I think we were really interested in exploring what happens when they've had a sense of liberty that has then been taken away.
Yeah.
Yes, we will.
The thing with the stake in the heart is sort of anti-phallic in a way, isn't it? It's saying all that testosterone energy that vampires seem to have needs to be, you know, stifled. It's right here now. Is that not what's happening in there, therefore?
Well, I suppose I was talking about staking Lucy, the vampire Lucy.
Oh,
so it's a man holding a pointed long object and jabbing it repeatedly into a woman.
I just think the vampires as men, really.
Oh, no, well, there's female vampires too. Yeah.
And actually, interestingly, in the book Dracula, there are more female vampires than there are men. The only male vampire that we're really aware of is Dracula.
Absolutely.
But in his castle, there are these three female vampires. There's also Lucy, who's been infected. So it's interesting. Also, then how we see the gender roles change once people become vampires, you know, and the three female vampires, there's a lot of sort of sexuality to them, and they talk about... the bites are talked about as kisses, aren't they? There are kisses for us all when they're going to bite Jonathan.
I was certainly interested in the idea that Mina embracing that kind of vampire side of her and that ability to lust and to face mortality was something that would empower her and make her stronger as a woman, that kind of wholeness.
And it does, really, because it's not until they've both bitten and they're both infected that they can really... have sex, is it, and consummate their relationship, because the whole way through our adaptation, through the two-hour show, there's this real sort of struggle to communicate between the two of them until they realise what's going on. They realise that Jonathan's been infected, they realise what happened to Lucy, and then they decide, well, we've got two choices here. We can stop this infection, or at least our part in it, or we can give in to it. And they decide to give in, and that's the moment at which they finally have this kind of release and they can start to communicate again. Mm-hmm. Which leads us into another question I'd written about the way that Dracula is communicating with everybody, because he's able to, even from, you know, a faraway land, he's able to communicate with the character of Renfield, who at the time is in an asylum and is talking about someone who's appearing at his window and who's bringing him gifts. And it's like he's kind of playing on everyone's basest fears, you know, their fears and their desires. But he's not actually there to talk to them, but he's able to kind of infect their minds, really, isn't he? And that's almost a stronger infection than the actual once you're bitten and the vampirism's in your blood. It's once Dracula's able to kind of communicate with you. That's when the trouble starts, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I see Dracula very much as a kind of a symbol of unconscious urges and desires within all the characters. You know, Mina is hypnotised to try and... You know, Van Helsing hypnotises Mina to try and find out where Dracula is, and obviously hypnosis was a technique that Freud used to get to the unconscious. But you could theorise that Stoker created that the kind of whole image of Dracula based on unconscious desires. So for me, that's why he's so in their heads and gets inside their heads, because he is the unconscious kind of rising to the surface. But obviously the play and the novel works on a whole other level, where he is just this supernatural being.
But he's quite greedy as well in the book, isn't he? Because I can't remember the exact quote now, but he says something along the lines of he wants to take the women are his territory, and he wants to get inside them to claim them. And he says something like, I'm taking your women one by one, or something like that, doesn't he? I think there's an awareness in the book that he is able to occupy, and I think that's quite interesting, psychologically occupy, as not just physically.
Yeah.
It could be about bad sex, really.
Well, mad sex or bad sex? Both.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of interpretations would look at it that way, and I think Stoker probably intended it that way. I guess we just haven't looked at it that way.
I wanted to talk a little bit about our production and about the process of adaptation. And Kate, I wanted to ask how you go from a book, which is a series of journal entries and newspaper clippings and reportage, and how you turn that into a play for essentially just two actors. There are just two actors in our show, but playing several different characters, so there's a bit of multi-rolling. What's that process that you go through?
I think one of the key things to starting a task like that is working out what's actually the sort of core action or the core emotional resonance within each journal entry, and working out what interactions are being spoken of within each journal entry, and then trying to find and imagine what that action might have been and how it might take the space of a scene. That's really what it is. You're looking for the core message of each journal entry, really, because you obviously you don't want just people to be reading out their diaries. I mean, that would be really tedious. So it is just about finding what is the interaction between the characters, what's being reported to us, and is it plot related, or is it a particularly interesting piece of psychology that we want to put into the text, really. Yeah.
And we talked a lot about, you know, what's the drive through your adaptation as well. What story are we telling, you know, what's your drive through it? And one of the lovely things when I started rehearsing the script was that we'd had endless conversations about it, and I'd read it lots of times. Then you get into the rehearsal room, and I was like, oh my goodness, Kate put this in and she put this in. there were still things that I'd missed, even though I'd read it a million times and we'd had all those conversations. There was just some incredible through lines and details of character and plot that you'd put in.
Yeah, I think you... Because it's such a big text, and because there's such a lot of travelling in it and a lot of plot-heavy related action, you have to decide what your sort of focus is and what your spotlight is, because you can't really achieve that entire narrative in a two-hour play. So you have to sort of think about that concept, and then when you're going through the individual bits, how do these pieces of action relate to your concept, and are they something you're going to keep? Are they going to be enriching? Are they going to be interesting? Or do you lose them? And, you know, what you lose is quite a big job in a text like this, really.
Yeah, really important part of it. And then when it comes to staging it, it's kind of similar thoughts about what are people's expectations when they hear it's Dracula. There's a set of expectations. And which of those expectations do I want to fulfil? Because they're exciting, and that's part of the joy of vampires, as we were talking about earlier. And which of those expectations do I want to question and reframe and subvert?
And it's amazing, actually, how not that many people actually know the novel that well, but everybody sort of knows some form of the story in some way. So when you're thinking about expectations, you never quite know which expectations you're thinking. Is it a film? Is it an impression? Is it the actual book itself? So it is quite interesting, that aspect of it, really, how a narrative can just seep into culture, and we all have a version of it in our brain.
Yeah, and I think that's also the fascinating thing about staging classics, is that what they mean changes over time, or the parts of them that resonate changes all the time, and it changes depending on the current political, social contexts.
We often find that with creation that in terms of audience response, people are a bit more malleable with something like Dracula or Henry V, which they haven't necessarily read over and over or seen several times. You know, you do a Macbeth and you change the witches and you get emails from people saying, I wanted them to have a cauldron. You did it. You're rubbish. But, like, you get a bit more freedom. With something we, the one of the sort of first shows we did in Blackwells was Jekyll and Hyde, and that's exactly the same as Dracula. You think, oh, yeah, I could sum up Jekyll and Hyde. You know what the phrase is, but you don't know what the plot is at all, unless you've, like, happened to have read it recently. Then the kind of the cultural sort of, the, you know, the comedy spoofs and the kids' versions and everything that you've kind of seen, you know, the, like, Sesame Street count, you know, like, that's probably more front of mind for people, even if you have read the book kind of 20, 30 years ago. So you get more freedom as a theatre producer if you go, although you've gone classic text because you're kind of hooking onto something that people recognise, you can sort of be a bit more free with it if it's something where you think, actually, most people haven't sat down with the York notes of this and gone through it and really kind of attached their own meaning to everything. And then you can just sort of have a bit more fun with it.
Which is good. And I think it's important because if you're putting a play on, if you're adapting anything, you have to ask, well, why? What can we offer? What's there to say now? What's important now? What's exciting now? What engages people now? Why do this now? And what can we say?
Yeah, and you have to expect it to be different too, because it's a completely different form, so it can never really be the same.
True. Yeah.
And it would be completely different with a different director, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, there's so many variables.
And well, so much of this version as well is the venue. Is the fact that we have been let loose in this amazing, like, bookshop feels like too small a word for the Norrington.
It's like a child's dream.
It is. And so many, either people have been in it before and they can't understand how it would be a theatre and they can't see, or you've never been into the Norrington room and you walk down into this, like, where's this been all my life? Like, it's so atmospheric.
It is the perfect setting for the piece, and obviously we worked a lot on really making it fit in that space and responding to that space, which has been utterly joyful. And Kate located most of the action in a library, which allows us to really interact with the books and really interact with the environment, and it's so exciting. And I think preferable to being in a theatre space in a lot of ways, because it really adds to the story. It adds to you the reality of it and the suspension of disbelief, the magic of it, because you're creating something in that space. But it's a really magical space. It's an exciting space.
I think as a practitioner as well, it makes you better because it challenges you more, and you know, having to use new spaces is difficult and make them effective in different ways. You know, you start to use different skills and push your practice a little bit further, so it's quite exciting in that way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I love responding to site-specific spaces because they ask me to tell the story in a slightly different way. You know, I'm very keen on responding to the space. Like we said earlier, the mid-century setting it was to do with really wanting to make sure the story sat in that world, and it looked like it was meant to be in that world. I didn't want it to be a stage, a play that happened to be in a bookshop. I wanted it to absolutely respond to the richness of that environment. And then it asks new questions about how you move the actors around the space. You know, when you're in a stage, there's lots of givens that work, and there's rules that we know about. But then when you're in a site-specific space, every space asks new things of how you literally, physically place the actors in the playing area. Yeah.
Sorry, was there someone I was going to... Sorry, was I looking the wrong way?
No, it was really to do with what was mentioning before. In that, I'm sorry, but I haven't actually read the book, but I have seen Hammer B movies with and Amy was in the 60s, and obviously Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee springs to mind. But there was a big theme then of Dracula being...
Of the vampire being, I think it's Peter Cushing along with his crucifix and the Christian remedy was the good of the, and that's quite, I don't know if anything like that was actually in that book originally or if it comes up in your conveyance of the power of, I don't know, sort of good and evil, the huge concepts of good and evil. I mean there's definitely religious concerns in the book, definitely, and sort of old ideas about how the world should be governed, which is essentially a religious principle, and how the new world should be governed with the movement of industry and technology and science and that kind of thing. So I do think that's in some ways quite loyal, but I do think adaptations like to really go for that crucifix and the religion aspect, perhaps more heavily than it is in the original text. A little bit more heavily. I mean, the crucifix is obviously important because it's the way that you get rid of the vampire.
Yeah, I think that's why it always comes through, because it is the most effective way to fight a vampire. So it kind of has to be in all adaptations. But yeah, it's certainly in the original. So I'd say they would be quite true to it. And there was, I think Stoker had a very clear sense within his writing of, you know, good and evil, Christian and non-Christian.
And different religions too, because of course Dracula is not from the same place. No. So there is the fear of the foreigner and the fear of other worlds coming in and infecting and changing England and England's progress and that kind of thing.
Which is a whole other adaptation.
There is a moment in our version where Jonathan, on his way to Castle Dracula, is given a crucifix by a kind of lady in an inn. Yeah. And it's a moment for him of his kind of rationalism versus superstition. So he sort of defends and says, no, well, that might be true in your country, but we don't have such traditions. And he takes it anyway, and it ends up being a comfort to him. So it's the moment where he stops being the kind of rational lawyer who's, you know, travelling across Europe
from
and
the
actually
modern world.
Who's the one who has all the answers, and he sort of has to give in to there might be something else going on here, and that he can't understand, he can't rationalise everything. I don't know what Mina would have done faced with that lady. I feel like Mina is in our version is potentially more rational than Jonathan. Whether she would have
She is more rational than Jonathan in the book. Jonathan's a bit crazy in the book.
He's struggling with the effects of having met Dracula throughout the novel, and Mina's incredibly kind of organised and meticulous. And I've said this before, but I've always loved the kind of funny references to how she wants to use her brain. She's like, well, when I'm getting married, I know I'm going to learn shorthand to help Jonathan. And she also memorises all the train timetables, all the trains to London, and she's very proud of this. That's an incredible brain. That's a woman that needs to use her brain more, like, for better things.
And she's always looking for evidence, isn't she? So she's going through all of Lucy's papers, trying to piece together what's happened. She's doing the kind of cognitive work.
Yes, she is.
Rather than looking at all of the sort of spooky coincidences, really, that have happened.
Have you found any indications why he placed Dracula in Transylvania?
Why he placed him in Transylvania? Yeah. I think you know more about this than I do, actually.
Did he travel, actually, over there?
I don't know, but there are local stories in that part of the world about vampires, he may have come across those, and that's my assumption.
I felt like we had a whole discussion about it that we seem to have lost.
Really?
there is an answer to that.
And there is...
Vlad
the Impaler or whatever. So there is that character.
Yeah.
So there's kind of mythology around vampires in that part of the world.
There's a really fascinating documentary, actually, on that you told me about on BBC iPlayer. It's the Tuesday documentary, and it covers this in it, and it's very interesting. And they talk about Transylvanian religion and principle and some of the influences of that and why it happened, but I can't remember what it is.
Was that the 1970s documentary?
Yes, it was really interesting. It's still on BBC iPlayer. It's the Tuesday documentary. It's really good.
Really good. And that kind of love of horror as well, which influenced that kind of horror film idea, and you were talking about Hammer horror films, influenced the directorial style as well.
I'm just aware that we need to start wrapping this up. So any more questions from the floor?
You condensed it to 2 hours. If you had all the luxury of having the time and you're allowed to let it run its natural course, How long would it be?
It depends on what the form was. I mean, if it's for the stage, you don't really want it to run. I think I'd be more tempted to do just a different adaptation rather than make one run longer, because I think you want it to be a manageable time frame. I think there's a, you know, 2 hours is a good amount of time. But there are things that I would like to explore about it. Like, I am really interested in the old and the new worlds in the Victorian period, and the influence of, you know, the foreign infection I find really interesting. And I think it's very particularly pertinent to today's politics and what's going on. So I think I'd be more likely to do something different rather than make something longer, in a sense, I think.
Yeah, I'd echo that. And like you say, the theme of the real fear of the travelling to the East that's within the novel, I think you could do something very pertinent with that adaptation to today's politics, like look at what that means.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be a different angle rather than a longer version, because I think... Well, like you were saying earlier, it's what you take out is actually what's interesting, because that is part of what you're saying. Yeah.
I feel like there's the potential for a sequel, though, isn't there? Because the moment at which you leave them, you want to know, well, what happens next now that Jonathan and Mina have given in to this? You know, what happens next, really, in Whitby and in the UK and in their relationship and, like, generally, like, you know, where's this going? Okay, any more questions? All right, well, we are doing the show every day until April the 14th. I should say every day except Sunday, so no Sunday shows, every other day. Till April the 14th in Blackwell's Bookshop, which is just over the road, 7:30 shows. We've got lots of flyers with us today which give you £2 off tickets. So if anybody wants to take one of those, there's a code to get £2 off your tickets. We hope to see you there. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Creation Theatre podcast. You can find more episodes and all the latest creation news at creationtheatre.co.uk.